Hey, folks, thanks for checking out the podcast this week. Before we get to my guest, I'm going to Rao's Italian Restaurant, the best Italian restaurant in New York, maybe the country. It is a tough table to get. Usually it's celebrities and big time politicians, that kind of thing, corporate bosses and all that. But someone's taking me. Yes, I have friends. So tweet at me at Paul Mercurio. Let me know what you think I should get. I'm not going to be able to decide because I'm going to love all of it. So I know what I'm doing. I'm definitely taking my bathing suit and I'm going into the kitchen after my meal and taking a swim in the spaghetti sauce. I'm Italian. I should be able to do that. Anyway, shoot me a tweet at Paul Mercurio. Let me know what you think I should get at Rao's. My guest this week, former governor of Virginia, Terry McAuliffe. Really, really cool conversation about Charlottesville, what happened, how it happened, why it happened. He gives you a blow-by-blow about it on my podcast. He also has a book out called Charlottesville, which we talk extensively about. So a really, really interesting conversation with a really great guy. And he's got some really cool personal stories. So I think you're really going to enjoy it. Shoot me that note at Paul Mercurio on Twitter. What should I get at Rao's? And enjoy Terry McAuliffe. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Welcome, first-timers. Very excited to have this guest on. We actually sort of crossed paths, but actually didn't in law school. We went to the same law school together. He is the governor, former governor of Virginia, former head of the Democratic National Committee, Democratic National Convention, campaign manager for Hillary Clinton in 2008, Governor Terry McAuliffe. Great to have you on the show.
Oh, great to be with you.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
We were just catching up about law school a little bit. I always wanted to talk to you because I did a transition away from Wall Street into entertainment. You did a transition within politics where you were a fundraiser, an advisor, and then decided to run and become a candidate. And I was curious, like, once you got into the seat of the candidate, did you then say to yourself, oh, I understand why I didn't understand what the candidate I was advising wanted me to do? Or did you start to see some things that you couldn't see from your vantage point as an advisor?
No. You know, listen, I'd started, I came from a business background. I started 30 companies.
Yeah.
I started my first business at 14, had to pay for college. So, you know, I'd always had a good business experience. I always loved politics. You know, I always did it for free. I mean, I never took any pay. I did it as almost a full time. You know, I got lucky with businesses early in life that I literally could take off and go volunteer and chaired Bill's campaign, Hillary's campaign.
Well, you were approached to work with Jimmy Carter and fundraising.
That's how I started.
Right. And what was it that sort of, you know, campaigned for you, so to speak, to do that? What do you think they saw in you? Obviously, a successful businessman, but fundraising for politics, a different animal. What do you think there was?
Yeah, so I was just started Georgetown Law School. And we'd only been in a couple of days, whatever.
Yeah.
One of my roommates from college was a guy by the name of Tom Donilon, who ended up being Barack Obama's national security advisor.
Oh, yeah.
Anyways, lived in a big group house. He came home one day, said, do you want to work on the campaign? I said, oh, heck, I can always go to law school. Left law school. Went to work for President Carter. Didn't know him at all. I'm a 21, 22-year-old kid.
Yeah.
I can always go to law school. And, Paul, I ended up going to 45 states that first year raising money. I'd never done it before. They literally would send me into a city and say, raise $300,000. Good luck. I ended up being the number one fundraiser. I became the finance director of the president's campaign at the age of 23.
How are you raising money with no skill set like that? What did you do? I mean, and you don't have the internet that you have today.
We didn't even have cell phones.
So, like, what are you doing?
You're on a hardline phone. You start calling people. You just chase them down the streets. And, you know, you're just tenacious about asking for money.
Yeah.
I mean, I've raised billions through my years. I don't even know how much. You know, as I say, I do it for free. I do it because I love to help candidates and so forth. But, Paul, what's the worst thing they can say to you?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have had a date in high school if I took no for an answer. I mean, God dang, I'm just starting out.
Tell people your job at 40, the business you started at 14. I love it.
Yeah, it was called McAuliffe Driveway Maintenance. You know, I had to, Paul, I was not going to pay for college, so I remember like it was yesterday. I was walking home. I'd been caddying golf bags at a golf course, and I'm 14 years old. I figured I've thrown my rifle away. I just spent, 4 hours going up and down hills carrying two bags, and I only made $8. And I figured I was a failure.
Right.
I said, I got to start my own business. I literally went home, typed up a letter, because I saw a guy sealing his driveway. That's where you put that hot tar liquid on.
Oh, it's brutal.
And nobody wants to do that.
No.
And I said, they'll hire a young kid to do it. I went home, typed up a letter, and handed out. I had 10 jobs my first week. My mother would take me to Kmart and get those 5 gallon barrels of tar.
I said, so you did the ceiling and the tarring?
I did all of that.
Oh my
That's
God.
How I started. But then I'm 15 now. I said, I got to go big. I said, I got to start doing parking lots, big parking lots. Now, you can't do that with 5-gallon barrels.
Yeah.
I called my Uncle Billy Byrne. He owned a dairy up there, Byrne Dairy. And I said, Billy, you must have some old trucks you don't use anymore. I said, I need a big truck because you have to buy the tar now in big 50-gallon.
Oh.
Huge concentrate.
Yeah.
And very heavy. Huge. And you can't do that in a car. Obviously, it wouldn't fit. He said, oh, I got some old trucks out in North Syracuse. We'll go look sometime. I said, no, Billy, I got to go today, Uncle Billy, because I had a contract to do a parking lot, a small 30, like, space parking lot. Yeah. I said, are you kidding me? He said, we're not going today. I'm busy. But he told me where it was in North Syracuse. So I drove out with my buddy, Joey Hartnett, gas, spark plugs, oil, and I found it. And there were a field, I'm telling you, Paul, of like 30 old trucks they didn't use anymore in a big field with high grass. I found the one I liked the most, big, huge dairy truck. And I worked on it for an hour or two, me and Joey. And I got in that, the big cab of the truck. I'm telling you, Paul, like yesterday, when I turned that key and that engine kicked on, I'm telling you, I still get goosebumps. So I drove it out of the field. I'm 15 years old.
I know that feeling. Because when I wrote I sold some jokes to Jay Leno when I was on Wall Street, and I'm doing huge merger deals on the front page of the Wall Street Journal.
Yep.
And he paid me $50 for the joke, and he did it on the Tonight Show. And it was just like you starting that truck up. A chill still goes on my, it just took my head and exploded. Yeah.
So I drove home down to Interstate 81, the interstate.
Yeah.
Past the North Syracuse State.
Well, you don't
police.
Have a driver's license, do you?
State police driver. I'm waving, I'm honking the horn at them. I have no license, and I have I have no license plates.
I love
it. Heck, I was an entrepreneur. Back then, you could get away with that kind of stuff.
Oh, I love it.
Now they're such lemon suckers. I mean, you can't do anything anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Was there ever an opportunity, opportunity is not the right word, but when you're advising or working for a candidate in any capacity where you feel strongly to push back override, or do you always have to kind of at the end of the day
defer? First of all, Paul, I didn't take any pay for any of this.
Right.
So I could say whatever the heck I want.
Right.
And I always did.
To Bill and to Hillary.
Absolutely. Just, you're wrong. This is that. I mean.
And they welcome that.
Yeah. I mean, go ahead and fire me. What do I care? You ain't paying me. I never had a problem doing that. And oh my goodness. Yeah. All the time.
Yeah.
Especially if you're the chair of a campaign. I mean, got to do this, got to do that. I mean, it's not, you don't have them, but you do have differences. Maybe you shouldn't do this. Maybe you shouldn't do that. But you're not really getting to screaming matches. But
so when you're chairing a campaign, there have to be different agendas happening within the campaign, within certain levels. How do you manage all of that?
Good question. It's like running a huge corporation.
Right.
A lot of fiefdoms. Everybody's got sort of their own ideas.
Everybody's spread all over the country.
All over the country. And you're trying to keep all of this moving. And listen, like the presidential this year, I mean, it is a battlefield.
Yeah.
And everybody's trying to kill you every day.
Yeah, exactly.
And everybody's shooting at you and all literally. Yeah. I mean, it's wild. And the key is, are you getting your message out every day, Paul?
Right.
Are you getting out what you think, And listen, when I ran for governor, I ran on a very progressive agenda for Virginia. I'm the first Democratic nominee for Virginia governor to get an F rating from the NRA. I was proud of it. I put it up on TV.
Yeah.
I was the first, I believe, candidate or elected official in the entire South to come out for marriage equality. I mean, this is not what normally Virginia had. I told women I'd be a brick wall to protect their rights. We just passed a horrible transvaginal bill. Remember that joke?
Oh, yeah.
Rachel Maddow and Jon Stewart killing us every day.
Yeah.
Legislation to shut the women's clinics down.
I was working on The Daily Show. I used to work on The Daily Show.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that.
And so I ran and I stopped all of it. Got elected.
How do you think you got elected?
Because people appreciated Paul. I never put my finger in the air. You may agree or disagree with me, but you always know where Terry McAuliffe is coming from.
There's no BS coming from you.
Yeah. And I used to say, this is what I believe I'm going to fight for. If you don't like it, don't vote for me. I'm okay with that. I would be okay losing. I don't like losing.
Yeah.
But I'd rather fight for the stuff I believe in than go down swinging than be a phony baloney. I mean, what, why be in politics?
It's hard enough just to remember your lies half the time.
Yeah. Like,
and so we have a book out, Beyond Charlottesville. And it's a really great read because it really takes you sort of inside almost minute to minute in certain circumstances and really helps you understand some things, answer some questions that I was yelling at the TV about, like, why'd they give him a permit? Stuff like that. But we'll get to that in a minute. But there were two rallies before, this is August 11th and 12th of 2017 when the Unity rally happened. But there was one in May, a white supremacist rally, May 13th, and another July 8th where David Duke spoke. Did you kind of see the bus coming down Broadway, so to speak, and could you sort of anticipate that this was going to happen and get this intense and violent?
Even before those two rallies, the city had come out right after Trump got elected, and the leadership said, oh, we're going to be the center of resistance to Trump. Not a good message.
Right.
You know, I said, I don't like that. I'm the governor. I'm trying to bring businesses in from around the globe. Yeah. Stop that. Yeah. You know, you're the center of technology. You're the center of innovation. You know, my job is to create jobs every day and help people.
Yeah.
And then they voted to take down the Lee statue. So it was a little combination of both of those. So right. people started. So the first rally, the KKK, and this, it's important you raise that because I think that set the mindset. So 50 guys come from the KKK. And I tried to tell everybody, you know, just leave them alone. These are 50 big old white guys. Yeah. They're going to stop at the first fast food joint and it's going to be over. Honestly, leave them alone.
Yeah.
But what happens is 1,000 protests, counter-protesters come up because you got the KKK marching down the street.
Right.
They chase them into a garage, a parking garage, won't let them out. State police, three canisters of tear gas go off and they disperse the crowd. Nobody hurt. Well, boy, oh boy. Charlottesville officials and my goodness, police brutality.
Right.
And it set a mindset that, you know, we're Charlottesville, we're a liberal town. Let people be and that kind of stuff. You know, at the end of the day, you're responsible for keeping people safe.
But that the reaction also sends a message to these other white supremacists that see this and say, we got to come to our brother's aid. Right?
Absolutely.
So it starts to embolden them.
Starts to percolate.
Wow.
And I had known so they filed for the permit.
Uh-huh.
And as I say in there, the city has 10 days to reject it or accept it or accept it with conditions. And they should have limited the hours instead of 12 to 5. It shouldn't have been in Emancipation Park because, Paul, it's too small.
Yeah, you wanted it at McIntyre Park.
I wanted to move it up.
But a judge shut you down.
ACLU sued us, and a judge ruled the ACLU.
And when he ruled, in your book, you talk about that he went after the anti-white supremacist social media posts as contributing to this. What was going? Is he just a conservative judge that was appointed? What's going on there? How does
And this is really, I have a hard time. And listen, I love the ACLU. But, you know, a lot of their, you know, board members I talk about resigned and said, First Amendment is free speech. I'm all for it.
Right.
However, if law enforcement is telling you we cannot control a situation due to the physical surrounding, park is too small.
Right.
1,000 armed people, 2,000 people yelling at the armed people, you can't control it. That should take precedence over the First Amendment.
Yes.
I'm not saying you can't do it. I'm just saying you got to put in a place where we can keep you separated.
Let's go back to our law school days. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater.
Right.
You have to.
Right.
First Amendment has to be weighed against public safety.
Right.
And that's by the way, that's the only thing I remember from law school. It's kind of impressive, right?
Impressive, Paul.
Come on. My mother would be proud of me.
Yeah.
And the permit, if I read this correctly, did not get reviewed or it fell through the cracks and there's the way the law is written, therefore it was approved? Is that essentially what
happened? Can't answer what the city, remember, this is all the city of Charlottesville, the state.
Look at you passing the buck, the governor.
No, I'm not passing the buck.
No, I'm just kidding.
As you read later
in
the book.
I'm kidding, I'm joking.
Or statue I was in charge of, I limited. No poles, no sticks, no masks.
Yeah.
I mean, I limited.
I mean,
I did not have authority
because
that's a city property. It wasn't a state property. But under city of Charlottesville law, if you don't take action on a permit within 10 days, then it's automatically approved. Mm. So they did nothing.
Mm. And you're stuck in that tiny park where you can't really properly control the crowds.
I mean, the sticks and poles. They came down Friday in the University of Virginia grounds, hundreds of them with tiki torches.
Yeah.
It was like 1933 in Germany.
You know, it's funny because on the Saturday, Brian Moran and Curtis Brown are walking around Charlottesville at like 8 o'clock in the morning. And he goes, it's almost like Jaws, we're going to need a bigger boat, right? He goes, there are these militia guys in fatigues with serious weaponry. And he goes, they ain't our guys. That's the quote, right? And he calls you up.
I said, well, who the hell are they?
Right.
He says, I don't know. I said, well, go find out.
Right.
They had better arms than we did.
Do you think the the carry law, Virginia's a carry law state.
Yeah, open carry.
And I kind of think, if you if you have the ability to walk around with weapons that people can see, that's going to amp up your racism, and that's going to amp up my feeling of intimidation by you.
No question.
Right?
These big semi-automatic weapons strapped to your chest and revolvers strapped to your thighs.
Could you say it would not have happened? Yeah, the march would have happened, and yeah, maybe there would be some scuffling and a few punches thrown. But can you say if it weren't an open carry state, maybe it wouldn't have risen to that level?
Yeah, I think that took the temperature up dramatically. Yeah. I mean, you have to understand, Paul, we got to and listen, I had known for months. As soon as we got wind, I stood up my fusion center, which is our state police, mm-hmm. law enforcement. Mm-hmm. We were working with DHS and FBI. I won't get into too much detail, but we had used undercover assets to infiltrate or get ideas of what was happening. Mm-hmm. We monitored all social media sites, and we knew, Paul, 2 months ahead of time that they were told to bring weapons and they were told to hurt people. Mm-hmm. This was not going to be some... you know, love and rally. This was not Woodstock.
And by the way, you're not getting any help from the president because when Duke made, you know, the president sort of said those horrible things about, you know, people when he was running that they come here and they're rapists and they're this. And so it starts, you start to catch a little wind of this. Okay, this guy's got, is a racist, right? Basically.
Yep.
Then he doesn't really poo-poo David Duke referring to him in that speech that he made. Where he says, you know, we're here to, whatever the exact words are, you know, we're here to support or help Donald Trump. And I remember the media was outraged. Like, why doesn't he just come back and disconnect from that?
Yeah.
So he's sending this sort of message to the whole.
No.
Yeah.
And you read in this book that many of the people who came felt emboldened by Trump.
Yeah.
By his language.
Yeah.
I mean, Paul, you're not born. I mean, these 1,000 people, every other word was the F and N word. They're screaming at the Jews, saying we're going to burn you and burn you like we burned you in Auschwitz.
Yeah, we're gonna put you in a camp is one of the things that they were yelling.
Yeah. I mean, it's just hard to fathom how we got this place in this country.
So you're kind of seeing that you're seeing from your vantage point as the governor that this thing could go sideways fast.
It got a hand very quick. I was very nervous. And so, as you see, Brian is kind of, you know, I'm not there. They don't want me there. Of course, you don't want the governor breathing down your back.
Yeah.
And knowing my personality, I would have wanted to wander out into the park, which would not
this have been. This is a man who was driving a dairy truck with no license. You don't mess with this guy. Right. He's a crazy man, I'll tell you. Crazy.
Don't let him walk around. So I was up in Northern Virginia and getting monitored. And then, you know, in the beginning, if you're watching TV, CNN kept running in the cable, the same skirmishes over and over. But, you know, Brian kept seeing it was getting worse and worse. And then they started coming in from all elements. And finally, at about 11:15, and understand, Paul, that the city is the one, not the state. I'm in a support role. I got 1,000 state police and National Guard, but I'm in a support role.
Right.
I'm not the one to call state of emergency. It's the city, not the state, because we're support. But about 11:15, as Brian says in the book, he went to see Colonel Flaherty, the head of the state police, and said, we got to call the governor. He's got to declare a state of emergency. Colonel Flaherty was a little conflicted because law enforcement, you know, chain of command.
Right.
He's reporting to the city of Charlottesville chief that day.
Yeah.
And Brian's watching out. He said, screw it. So he calls me up, says, governor, you got to do it. I said, screw protocol. I declared a state of emergency.
Right.
I said, send him in, clear the park. So my state police went in, riot gear, got on the bullhorn, said, you have 11 minutes to clear the park. 11 minutes later, Paul, park was totally clear. We then sent in the National Guard. They secured the park. Feeling pretty good.
Yeah.
Everything's fine. Couple fights, couple skirmishes, no property damage.
Right.
About an hour later, Brian calls me back up, says, you got the TV on? I said, yeah, but I don't see anything. He said, watch. He said some young maniac just weaponized his car ran through the crowd and killed 32-year-old Heather Heyer and injured dozens of people. So I arrive. I come down. We're going to do a big press conference. But here's the problem. I had talked to the president that day, that morning.
You did. Let me just say something. You said, I got to tell you, man, I'm so glad you said this. I'm like, what a set of cojones on this guy that you said this to the president. You said, quote, we have to bring people together. All this stirring people up on race is wrong and going to hurt America. And then you hung up the phone and said he didn't really seem to hear and connect with what you were saying. And that concerned you because he was focused on the economy. And
so I went through and told him, explain what happened, here's and here's and here. And I'd already, you know, I was chairman of the governor. So, I mean, I dealt with him. I was the chairman of the NGI. I dealt with him, you know, in office since he became president. And I had dealt with him on the Muslim ban, which I was very upset about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those seven countries where no one could come from those countries.
Right.
You know, I had kids coming over who were U.S. citizens being detained at Dulles Airport. I physically had to go up myself and demand their release. And these are U.S. citizens, Paul.
Yeah.
I was mad about his whole immigration policy. He was driving people underground. He was really hurting our business in Virginia.
Mm.
So I then said at the end of the phone call, I said, you know, Mr. President, you and I got to work together. This hateful language has got to stop. I said, it's really going to be detrimental to our economy. I said, you know, I finally got the Virginia economy humming and this is going to hurt us. And he immediately just took that to talk about the U.S. economy
yeah.
and pivoted in. And he said, well, I'm going to go do my press conference. And I hung up and I thought he'd do the right thing, but I was a little concerned that he pivoted off. But, you know, when I hung up the phone, Paul, how hard is it to condemn neo-Nazis?
Yeah, exactly. That's one where you're not like going.
They killed 6 million Jews.
Yeah.
And, I mean, really? This.
Yeah.
I mean, they all had, really?
Yeah.
And then I wait half an hour and a half, 2 hours. He kept delaying his press conference. I'm waiting to do mine. I couldn't do it till the president goes.
Why do you think he was delaying?
You know what happened. You know that the White House, he was in Rutherford, New Jersey. He was at his golf club up in his guys in the White House. I don't know if it was Bannon, Miller, I don't know who. No way, Mr. President. No way are you going to condemn neo-Nazis.
Yeah, you're right.
And they changed him. And this is what always happens. And I couldn't believe it. He said there were good people on both sides.
Yeah.
Paul, there weren't.
Yeah.
These neo-Nazis. Heather Heyer was fighting against hatred that day.
Yeah.
These were horrible, screaming things I cannot even say in this studio.
You're right.
And it was baffling. So I had to go out and do my press conference. And I told him to go home, get the hell out of America. They're not.
I remember that. It was really.
I had to do it.
It was really forthright.
They're not
I really
patriots or cowards. And then I learned that my helicopters, Trooper 1, had gone down and crashed with my pilot, state police pilot, and a member of my security detail who had been with my family for a couple of years.
Yeah, you were close to those guys.
Oh, my goodness. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
It was what a day.
Do you look back and say, you could have done something a little different leading up to that or during it? Or do you feel like you kind of were?
I don't know what else to state, because as you read in the book, I had sent, so, you know.
You did a lot. I'm not suggesting you didn't.
No, no. And you like, listen, it's about learning. I mean, listen, at the end of the day, this leadership's about checking in. But, you know, we kept warning the city. And at one point, I'm on vacation with my family and my chief of staff calls and said, the city's just not listening to us. So actually the memo to me, which I recited to the mayor when I called him and went point by point, you know, no sticks, no poles, blah, blah,
right.
blah, move the park.
Right.
I called the mayor when it went through it with him, and I said, I'm sending Colonel Flaherty and two of his assistants this afternoon. They will be in your offices with the city council and the city. They are going to brief you. And as it's quoted in the book, one of the city council members said he was scared to death after the briefing.
Mm.
But I can't understand, like, just stupid stuff like they didn't put barricades around the streets. So the car that this guy rode through, it was a wooden sawhorse. A Prius would have taken it out. I mean, you should have had dump trucks.
Especially at that point, because it's now the second day. I mean, there was a precursor to that the night before.
Yeah.
So
1,000 people chanting, Jews, we you want replace
yeah, that's
us.
An Come indication on. That there's going to be a problem. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. You talk about balance, that there has to be a balance between First Amendment rights and sort of these people that, you know, feel that their white rule or white race is being sort of taken away from them. What's the balance? How do you balance?
Well, I think and I talk about it at the end of the book. You know, the book ends with how do we go from here on racism and all that. But I also talk about practical application. So then they filed for another permit to come to Richmond to do the Lee statute, which is controlled by the state. That's
right.
Controlled by me. So I did an executive order 67. I said, nope. I'm not giving any permits out. I'm doing a review process because the permit for the Lee statue in Richmond allowed 5,000 people in this little roundabout in the middle of downtown Richmond.
Yeah.
Paul, if you and I stacked people 50 on top of each other, we weren't going to get 5,000 people. So I stopped all that. And then so they decided they weren't going to come. And then a small little group showed up. They were on the sidewalk in Richmond. My good friend, the mayor, worked with us and we worked with it. We banned poles, sticks, masks. Because what happened in Charlottesville, all the people on social media, they took their pictures of all the white supremacists and the neo-Nazis. Right. And it was great, Paul, because it became evidence to indict them. Right. In addition, people lost their job. The guy who worked at the famous hot dog stand in Berkeley lost his job the next day.
Oh, yeah, I remember
because they
that.
Put
yeah.
his picture up. Yeah, on. Yeah, so yeah. they put it all up. The bad news, good news, horrible what happened. The good news is it pretty much destroyed the movement because most of these folks got indicted. People lost their jobs. A Marine the other day, you read that, he got thrown out of the yeah. Marine Corps.
Yeah.
It shattered their lives.
Right.
They're going to think twice now about doing it.
What is putting on just, I know you're not on the inside, obviously, but you come from the world of politics and being a yeah. political strategist and obviously a governor. What is Trump's mindset in playing this race card so just defiantly and in a very disgusting manner? Obviously, to keep his base revved up. But beyond that, doesn't he worry that those people who were on the fence who voted for him in 2016, he's pushing them the other side? What do you think the calculation there is politically?
Because
there clearly is. He's yeah. a very he's an no astute question. Politician yeah. and a great marketer.
Yeah.
So he's got something figured out yeah. that he wants to do.
So keep his base fired up.
Yeah.
But he can't win with his base. That's about 40%.
Right.
So he believes, and I think wrongly believes, he believes that by doing this, there are a lot of these neo-Nazi, white supremacist, racist haters that didn't vote last time, and he's going to go find them and root them out of their holes, and they're going to come out and vote in 2020. I think most of the people who were inclined to believe in these things, they voted in 16.
Right, yeah.
What he has done is so alienate independent women and other groups. It's very hard for him to win again.
I don't know. You know, I was talking, I was watching, I think it was MSNBC. They were interviewing one of the congressmen, and he was saying, you know, look, you know, I know it's a different thing, but it's the Mueller probe and everything else. He goes, in Ohio, they're not talking about any of this stuff. They're talking about the economy and am I going to get health care that I can afford? I don't know that enough people get fired up about this. That's my concern. Like you may use the word too comfortable. You yeah. say, this is from the book. The truth is revealed in Charlottesville. We are a divided country today, stuck in the past. Racism still rampant. My message is stop being comfortable.
Yeah.
Why are we so comfortable?
As I say, the other benefit of Charlottesville is it ripped the scab off of racism. Mm. Far too long, Paul, whites in this country who are not comfortable talking about racism, who were not comfortable talking about the history of racism in our country, felt that, you know, they had dealt with it and sort of swept it under the rug and everything's fine.
Mm.
It isn't fine.
Yeah.
We realized in Charlottesville, but what we realized, and this is the point I'm trying to make, is we got to come together as a nation, but we will never deal with the effects of racism if we don't deal with inequality in schools, in African-American school districts,
yeah.
predominantly inferior structures and equipment and teachers and all the issues that
go
with that.
It's all interconnected.
We got a racist criminal justice system.
Yeah.
I mean, Paul, I pardoned a guy when I left office. I did the most pardons, no surprise of any governor of Virginia history. Mm. But I pardoned a guy, Lenny Singleton. This guy, he was a coke addict. He did 5 robberies. Nobody ever hurt. But the total theft was less than $550 5 times. You know, he was looking for money for drugs. Mm. Guess what his sentence was in Virginia? Just take a guess. For $537.
I don't know, 3 years?
3 years. Two life sentences plus 130 years.
What?
I'm not making this up.
What is the opinion on that?
He's black.
No, when they wrote the opinion, what was the justification in the sentencing?
There isn't. By the time I got to him, he'd served 20 plus years in jail.
That's disgusting.
So he and I were just honored at the Innocence Project.
That's great.
But I mean, I could tell you a lot of these stories.
Yeah.
My point is, it still is an unfair system. We can't pretend that it's gone away. Do something. And all these reconciliation commissions, a bunch of white people sitting around talking to each other, making themselves feel good.
Yeah.
Do something.
Yeah.
Vote. 92 million people didn't vote in 16.
Yeah.
Vote.
Yeah.
And get out there and shake it up. Deal with education. Deal with housing. Deal with mental health. Deal with a lot of these issues in a horrible criminal justice system.
And also not be divided. I mean, we're divided, so divided politically now.
Yeah.
Like if I'm on the left and I don't agree with somebody on the right, then I'm evil.
You're
up and down.
You're a horrible person.
Oh, up and down. It used to be like, you know, you could.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
I think racism is embedded in tribalism, right?
Yeah.
And the sense of fear, right? And I think what happens is tribes, people, white people or black. Look, there was a, by the way, just white people aren't just the racist ones. I don't know if you remember Steve Harvey about 4 or 5 years ago was hosting the Miss USA pageant and he got, or Miss Universe pageant, and he got the name wrong. It was Miss Colombia that won, but he said it was Miss Venezuela. I printed out, I actually tried to talk about it in my act, but the language is so vile. All of these Colombians started calling him the N-word.
Awful.
And I'm like, it's like, okay, it's everybody. And the point is, to me, if I don't understand your tribe, right? Okay, I'm black, I don't understand whites. I'm white, I don't understand Mexicans, right?
Yep.
Then anything you do, I'm afraid of because it's going to, if I don't understand you, I feel threatened by you. And so I'm just going to huddle up and I'm going to protect myself. And I think there has to be some coming together in addition to all the things you talked about, a better justice system, yep. a better educational system, where we're not the boogeymen to each other if we're from different groups. And I don't know if that's too pie in the sky, but I do think that there's this very raw sense of tribalism that contributes to this.
And let's cut to the chase, too. We got to admit that when President Obama won and there was a black man in the White House, to many of these folks, that was just too far to go.
Yeah. And it woke them up in a bad way.
In a bad way.
Yeah.
And then when Trump coming in, the things he's, I don't blame Trump for specific acts, Paul, but I do blame him because the atmosphere he has created,
yes.
that divisions are okay, that hate language, speech language is okay. Right. It's not okay.
Right.
So he has fostered this.
Right.
We can get back. We got to elect a president that can unify and bring people back together.
Yeah.
This is what the Democrats need to talk about, but it's a big challenge for us. It's not going to happen with Donald Trump. He doesn't care about, you know.
Here's the thing about his policies, too. He's not a crazy, just in terms of his policies, he's not a crazy right winger. He's a little off center on terms of the right. The problem is that all of this other stuff has made him look so bad.
Yeah.
I think he'd be a fairly acceptable, you know, I don't want to say he's Reagan, but, you know, he's not Barry Goldwater in the sense of these extreme views on policy and everything else. He's just got these cards that he's playing.
And he tweets
and I get so frustrated with CNN and MSNBC because it's like, you know when you go up to a fish tank and you're going to feed the fish and you screw at the fish and you hold it like that and you go like that and the fish follows your finger?
Yeah.
Well, that's what he's doing with the media because he throws these tweets out and everybody goes down that rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And then meanwhile, his other hand, don't look at this hand because the other hand's doing this.
Well, he doesn't want you talking about the Mueller report, so he comes out with Elijah Cummings. Right. I mean, there's a pattern to what he does here.
Right. But nobody's going like, stop, I'm not going to cover that. Right.
Because you know, the sad part for Trump, sad part for our country, but sad if Trump had come in and done infrastructure as he promised, every mayor, every governor would have loved him. Had he fixed health care, not getting rid of Obamacare, but tweaking it like we all knew it needed to be done.
Yeah.
Talk about the economy and stay off of these socially divisive tweets.
Right.
This guy would have been unbeatable.
Right. Well, here's a guy that doesn't trust his own instincts. Yeah. I don't think he trusts that he's a good enough politician that will work, right? Like sometimes you try too hard to get the girl. Try less, you know. There's
a lot, as we know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, as we wrap up,
we got 25 women have come out and complained of sexual.
It's like there's a great article, by the way, called "The Tale of Two Jeffreys" about Jeffrey Epstein and another guy named Jeffrey who wasn't rich in the same country that did the same thing, and one gets put in jail, and Epstein just walked. It's called "The Tale of Two Jeffreys."
Yeah.
Apropos of nothing here, but you know, toward the end of the book, you say maybe Charlottesville was the shock to the system we all needed to jumpstart real dialogue. It matters what we do. Charlottesville was a catalyst. And I just want to say, 3 weeks ago, if I read that, I'd believe you. But now, after send her back, and that nonsense, I don't know that we're in a different place as a result of Charlottesville. And I do think we should be. You're right. But that broke my heart. You know what I mean? He said it, and then them chanting it was like, have we made even one step forward? I mean, thanks to people like you in a book like this, we're putting it out there like, hey, you know, we got to deal with this.
Yeah. Paul, we got to get rid of them. I mean, if you really want to make a change.
You know what? I'm going to run.
Sure. But you got to get rid of Trump. And I'm really confident we are. I really do. We're going to pick up those 77,000 votes in those three states. But he can't get over 50%, hasn't been able to get over 50%.
Yeah.
Listen, the guy, you know, he's not a Republican. Mm. He's Trump.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a moral core. I dealt with this man. Mm. He doesn't care about any issue. Mm. He will not fall on the sword for anything. Right. What will help him get reelected? And what will get him good press? I mean, it's sad. He sits up there in his underwear up in the residence and he's reading right. and watching Fox and right. Friends in the morning. Honestly, right. come yeah. on.
And he's appointing people based on how well they perform on Fox right.
and look
Friends.
At how many acting secretaries we have now. Yeah. I mean, it's awful.
Yeah. Are you got the itch to get back into politics as a candidate?
Well, I've been busy, so I decided not to run for president about 6 weeks ago. I really wanted to do it. I would have thought a Southern governor, born in New York.
Yeah.
With a very progressive record, but also a very pro-jobs record, was a good message.
And a practical guy, too.
Yeah,
very practical. Street smart.
And lay it out. And, you know, I would love to have done that debate. I mean, imagine me and old Trump.
Oh, my God.
Me and Butterbean going at it. I mean, God dang, you would have sold tickets to that baby.
Oh, my God.
Remember, I once wrestled an alligator for $15,000.
Yeah, tell them that story real quick.
Yeah, you know, I got challenged. So I spent about 10 minutes in a pit with an 8-foot. 280-pound alligator.
Where do you grab the alligator? Like under the armpit?
So
you get it in a headlock?
You get your two front knees behind its two front legs.
Yeah.
And then they bring the snout up, and you got to hang on to that thing for dear life.
Oh, the snout's not taped?
There's a rope on it, and then they bring it up, and cut the rope.
Oh.
No. You don't get the $15,000 unless you do it the real deal.
Whoa.
They used to do it like every third Saturday, the Seminole Indian Tribe. I was the only white guy to ever do it.
Hang on a second. I want McAuliffe nominated for president. This guy wrestled an alligator.
How many people do that? I spent and I got the $15,000. And then you hold it up and you got to hang on for dear life. And you bring it up against your face.
It's all slimy.
And the eyes right here. And he's in a swamp. He stinks. But you got to be careful. The tail is very powerful. It can snap your vertebrae in half. So he's trying to knock you off and bite you. So you got to stay steady. You got to keep your knees down.
Stay low.
With his legs right there and bring it and hold
Isn't
on.
Isn't he slippery? Isn't it slippery?
It's scaly. It's not really slippery. It's scaly. It's like dried mud.
Yeah.
But you can't let the mouth open. If the mouth opens, you're done because it's very quick. And he'll like.
Are you halfway cheetahs. Through that going, this is a bad decision?
Well, once we started, I wouldn't think of anything but gripping that thing like there's no tomorrow and not letting go. In fact, Chief Billy, who did put it together for me, James Billy, he lost his thumb a couple years later. He wears it around his neck. He had it put in formaldehyde or whatever.
He wears his thumb
around his neck. Yeah.
What did your wife say about the fact you were wrestling an alligator?
Well,
was she
luckily,
a little upset?
I was not married at this point. This was 1980.
Oh.
Yeah, I was a young bachelor working for the Carter campaign.
There you go. That's a great story to get a woman.
I did get some great dates out of it. I'm not going to lie to you. I go to the bar and but I was in Newsweek and everything. I mean, I'm 22 years old. It was great.
Yeah, you've had a full life.
I haven't had a great experience.
Yeah, it's really a lot of fun.
Great.
Yeah, yeah. And the book is Beyond Charlottesville, Taking a Stand Against White Nationalism. Please read it. It's an important book, and it's a really great timeline in a way of really sort of the machinations of what was going on behind the scenes and what led to it. And
hopefully it makes you think.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure it will. It made me think and it answered some questions for me, too. Great to have you on.
Well, great to see you again after... Like 40 years.
40, we're like, we probably ran into each other at our Georgetown Law School. Yeah.
In fact, this year is my 35th reunion from Georgetown.
Oh, you going?
Well, yeah, I live in McLean, so yeah, a couple of my buddies called me, so I'll go down. Yours will be next year, I guess.
Yeah, I went down and did like an entertainment sort of forum for the mainly for students interested in the entertainment world. And, from my perspective of having sort of practiced and then sort of now being on the other side as talent and producer and writer or whatever. And it was fun. It was interesting because they didn't really have much of an entertainment law focus when I was there. And
well, you're the real deal. You actually practiced.
Yeah,
I never did.
I liked it. I didn't hate it. I was doing a lot of hostile deals. Working
if you
all
read
night.
My first book called What a Party, I talk about the one case I represented, 3 o'clock in the morning. Disorderly conduct against a bartender up at Dewey Beach, Delaware. I'd hit a few cocktails, but that's okay. And I went into the back of the courthouse. They have a courthouse there at Dewey Beach.
Yeah.
And they bring a JP in. And they say, sir, are you registered, licensed in the district or Delaware? And I said, no, but I'm a member of the United States Supreme Court Bar, which I was. But they didn't know. You send $50 in, you get three sponsors. You remember, you would have thought Judd for the defense had walked in, man. I owned that courtroom.
Did you really?
And guess what? We got them off. Nice. I retired 1-0.
There you go.
Went back to the bar where the kid worked. We drank till 6 in the morning. Went home, got in bed. My wife says, where the hell have you been? Not good having your husband rolling around at 6 in the morning in Dewey Beach. I said, honey, you're not going to believe what I did this time. Give me 2 hours sleep and I'll give you the whole story.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, I hope you run for president.
All right, buddy. Thank you, Paul.
Great to have you on the show. Terry McAuliffe, Beyond Charlottesville. Get the book.
I got to talk to this guy again. Terry is really, really cool. The governor is an amazing guy with a whole history that we didn't even get a chance to get into. But really interesting to hear the conversation he had with President Trump and how that went down. Kind of scary. Anyway, hope you enjoyed it. And we'll see you guys next week. We've got a great guest coming on next week. And go to iTunes. Leave some nice comments about the podcast. Always helps. And tell your friends about it. All right, guys. See you next week.